This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how President Biden's inner circle kept his cognitive decline a secret. A few days ago, we learned that former President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer. According to a statement, the cancer has spread to his bones, but it, quote, appears to be hormone sensitive, which allows for effective management. He and his family are reviewing treatment options, and they've thanked Americans for the outpouring of support and well wishes. The news came as other questions about Biden's health were back in the spotlight. Throughout his presidency, Biden, who is now 82 years old, faced scrutiny about his age and his mental cognition, so much so that he eventually ended his 2024 re-election campaign. And new reporting, done entirely separately from his cancer diagnosis, reveals the extent to which the former president's mental acuity appeared to be getting worse while in office, and how the people in his inner circle concealed it.
Our reporting suggests that this was a deterioration.
That's CNN's Jake Tapper.
And they were not only lying to the public and the media, they were lying to their cabinet. They were lying to Democratic donors. They were lying to Democratic office holders.
Jake Tapper and Axios's Alex Thompson are out now with a book called Original Sin: President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. It's full of damning revelations by the people who saw Biden up close through his presidency and campaign that suggest what many Americans had long been concerned about, that Biden's ability to serve as president, mentally and physically, deteriorated. Biden has said that claims about his declining health during his presidency are wrong and that there is nothing to sustain them. But Alex says their reporting shows otherwise.
We had cabinet secretaries, multiple cabinet secretaries tell us that, you know, if there was a crisis at 2 a.m., they would have been worried. They did not have confidence that he would have been a reliable commander-in-chief with a middle-of-the-night crisis.
I sat down with Jake and Alex a few days before we learned of Biden's cancer diagnosis, so that won't come up in this conversation. Alex, I should say, was reporting on claims of Biden's cognitive decline while he was in office, and has been loud and critical of the media's general failure to cover this story. I asked Alex what changed in what his sources were telling him after Election Day 2024.
I think both of us believed and sensed that there was more to the story, and people would finally be candid in a way that they hadn't been, in part because I think there was fear of being seen as disloyal, and also fear of, if they were candid, they would be helping Donald Trump. And I think as people were reckoning with what had just happened, that they were finally willing to be candid about what they had seen in a way that, you know, honestly, I think was shocking to both of us.
It was stunning. So we did more than 200 interviews. We interviewed more than 200 people, I should say, because some of them were multiple interviews with the same person. Mostly Democratic insiders. Almost all of the interviews after the election. And some of them are still grappling with what they were part of.
Mm. With all the people that you ended up speaking with, I mean, how far back do concerns really go? I mean, when did you first start hearing from your sources concerns about Biden's cognitive health and his ability to run again?
Well, the first time I heard any serious concern from anybody that would know was David Axelrod in 2022. He did an interview with the New York Times in which he said something along the lines of, Joe Biden really needs to think about this because he's asking voters to trust him to run the country for four more years, at the end of which he'll be closer to 90 than 80, which is a pretty reasonable thing to say. Our reporting, though, however, suggests that the first time somebody really expressed shock at the diminishment of the president was in 2015 when he was vice president and Beau, his beloved Beau, tragically passed away from brain cancer. And one aide described to us, and it's in the book, that it was like watching water be poured on sand in terms of how much his psychic strength melted away. Mm. And then it just got worse and worse. But our reporting is that there's like a functioning Biden and a non-functioning Biden, and the non-functioning Biden would rear his head every now and then, forgetting names of top advisor is losing his train of thought in a way that was uncomfortable, things beyond just aging into non-functioning at a concerning level. And then the next time it got really bad, according to people close to him, was tied to his other son, Hunter. The plea deal fell apart in the summer of 2023, thus increasing the likelihood that Hunter would, you know, not just go to prison, but perhaps spiral out of control because of his addiction, perhaps commit suicide. Things that Hunter was saying to the family: they're trying to kill me, they want me to overdose, things like that. And so the very real and tragic fear that Joe Biden has and had of losing a third child, because he lost a first child in that horrible, tragic car accident in 1972 with his wife. Then he lost his son, Beau. And here is the only other person left from that car accident from 1972, Hunter. He feared that he would lose his third child. And so the next scene was June 2024, when Hunter's convicted of a crime. And it was during those two inflection points that he really seemed to, according to top aides, melt away. But I didn't know that until we started writing this book.
Mm. And of course, very soon after, as you're describing what was happening in June of 2024 with his son Hunter, soon after he had to throw himself into debate prep, the first debate between Biden and Trump that, of course, Jake, you moderated. Yeah. The world watched. It was a debate performance that just shook the country at what they were seeing of the president.
Look, there's so many young women who have been, including a young woman who just was murdered, and he went to the funeral. The idea that she was murdered by an immigrant coming in, they talk about that. But here's the deal: there's a lot of young women are being raped by their in-laws, by their spouses.
Jake, you experienced it from a very different vantage point, yeah, being a moderator. I mean, what do you remember of that night? What were you feeling? What were you thinking?
Well, first, I have to say, he showed up very late. There's a walkthrough that happens for candidates for debates. The candidate goes through and looks, and which is your camera, which is the other guy's camera, are you on air when they're answering, finding out the rules, just going over everything, getting somewhat comfortable with the room, et cetera. Both Trump and Biden were invited earlier in the day. The debate was to start at 9 p.m. Eastern. They both arrived late, which is not surprising for either man. But Trump was, you know, he's a creature of television. He knew the questions to ask, and what if I want to get another point in, and blah, blah, blah. He was asking everything just the way anybody, you know, loaded for bear would do. Biden doesn't show up. And it's like 8:15, 8:20, somebody from CNN calls the campaign, like, where is the candidate? He needs to do the walkthrough. The campaign says, well, he doesn't think he needs to do this. He's done so many debates. Okay, well, that's a weird thing to say for a guy who is historically not a great debater. But all right, he finally shows up at 8:30. He's doing the walkthrough. I'm supposed to be on stage just getting comfortable myself with my co-moderator, Dana Bash. We don't go out there till like 10 of because Biden has been so late, which that itself was strange. So then the debate starts. Biden walks out, looking every day of 81, you know, with his shuffle because of his degenerative spine and other issues. Trump walks out, you know, very Trump, and the debate begins. Within that first block of answers, I knew something was wrong. It wasn't his first answer. He was weak and his voice was reedy and he sounded like he had a cold. He kept coughing. But I think it went Biden, then Trump, then Biden. I think it was the second one. He lost his train of thought to a degree that was very concerning. He had real trouble coming up with words to express himself. System,
making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do dealing with everything we have to do with. Look, if we finally beat Medicare.
And look, we're all human. We all, you know, this morning I couldn't come up with the word above when I was, you know, I hadn't had my cup of coffee yet, but whatever. Like, I mean, it happens.
Right.
But this was something else. And this is a president of the United States, and communication is a very important part of the job. As one top aide said to us, being president is two things, making decisions and communicating them. And this top aide said they always had faith in Biden's decisions, but he could never really communicate them to the country, and it got worse and worse as his term went on. Mm-hmm. So he gives that answer where he says, we finally beat Medicare. And I think he meant we finally beat COVID, but I don't know what he meant. I mean, honestly. And we had iPads in front of us so Dana and I could communicate with the control room because we can't talk. And I wrote, holy smokes. And, you know, I think just objectively, this was the worst debate performance in the history of presidential debates, period. Mm. And there were other answers he gave that were serviceable. But by the end of it, we couldn't believe it. We just couldn't believe it, what we were seeing. I think it was worse in person, although I have watched it on video, and it was pretty bad on video. But like seeing in the flesh, there's just something about the frailty and the sadness of it all. And then after the election, we wanted to find out what of that, of what we saw that night, how often had that happened before?
Mm.
And the truth was, it had happened before, and people told us, and you can read their accounts in the book, whether it's Congressman Mike Quigley in Ireland watching this happen behind the scenes in April 2023, or Biden not being able to come up with the names of top aides, Jake Sullivan, Kate Benningfield, in December 2022. It happened. And we talked to the witnesses and the fact that this was hid from us, it's still upsetting.
Mm. Well, let's go back to some of the early accounts that you heard about, at least. You said for some people, their concerns went back to 2015 or so. During the 2020 campaign and Biden's early years in office, what kinds of stories were you hearing from folks that you spoke to? Alex, maybe you can tell us examples and things that stood out to them as incidents that struck them that something was different about President Biden.
Yeah, I think when some aides first started really noticing it was late 2019. So this is right before the 2020 primaries. And Biden is on a bus tour through Iowa. You know, they're trying to sort of save his candidacy. And they work him hard. You know, it's nonstop. And so he's worn out and they can tell. And at one point, he can't remember the name of Mike Donilon, who's worked with him since the early 80s. And everyone sort of just like side-eyes each other, right? But they don't say anything. And the sort of rationalization is, listen, non-functioning Biden, as we sort of call it, it's not that often they see it. And good Biden, functioning Biden is way more present than non-functioning Biden. But there are moments that give people pause. It's really when, you know, he has to pick up the travel schedule and do these really grueling international trips that aides start noticing, especially by late 2022, the ratio of functioning and non-functioning Biden starts to change. And also non-functioning Biden gets more worrisome.
In what ways?
Well, it's not just forgetting a name. His schedule became so much more limited that aides would try to schedule meetings at certain hours and just weren't able to. His energy diminished significantly. And also his ability to, you know, just give a speech, a basic speech. Someone put it as like the paragraphs would get shorter. The sentences had to get shorter. The speeches just generally had to get shorter. They didn't have confidence of him being able to speak significantly. And then there's also the lapses that were televised of him, you know, giving a shout out to a dead congresswoman.
Representative Jackie, are you here? Where's Jackie? I didn't think she was going to be here.
Or, you know, mixing up Macron and Mitterrand.
And I sat down and I said, America's back. And Mitterrand from Germany, I mean, from France, looked at me and said, you know, how long are you back for?
You know, those things became more common, not just in front of the cameras, but behind the cameras.
Mm. And your reporting also points out, you know, even in smaller meetings, it seems like closed-door meetings, there were more examples of things that were becoming concerning to people. For example, him using a teleprompter for even kind of small addresses with small groups, having note cards in front of him in meetings and reading from them, really. Of course, the size of his inner circle becoming smaller and smaller and him holding that very close. Can you put into context how unusual any or all of this is for a president?
It's very unusual. I've been covering the presidency since Bill Clinton, And, you know, they're all different and they all have tight circles and they all have insularity, of course. But the idea that what people in the administration called the top aides, they called them the Politburo, Donilon, Ricchetti, and some others. And the Politburo limited President Biden's interaction with people to the degree that cabinet secretaries thought that they were being kept at bay. And they thought it was weird and they didn't understand it. And one of them said, you know, decisions about the economy would be made without even talking to Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary. It was that insular and that closed off. So, I mean, when people, it's funny to me when people, when Democrats talk about, oh, nobody elected Elon Musk. Well, nobody elected Mike Donilon. Nobody elected Steve Ricchetti. And they wielded a lot more power than Elon Musk did and a lot less publicly. So in any case, one of the cabinet secretaries told us they were kept at bay. They hated what was going on. And then finally, they had they got to meet with the president for one meeting, and he was basically incoherent. He was mumbling. He seemed out of it, and it was a shocker. Now, the listener at home right now or driving or whatever might think, okay, well, why didn't that cabinet secretary come forward? Okay, I agree with that notion, but the truth of the matter is that even now, as we come forward with this book, which has been fact-checked by the top fact-checker at The New Yorker. We hired him to make sure that it was as tight as possible. I mean, any errors in there are ours, not his, but like we really wanted to make sure this was as tight as possible. There were anecdotes that maybe we were 80% on, and we're like, let's not include it. Let's just only use the stuff that we're 100% on. And even now, people are privately talking to us about like, thank you so much for doing this, thank you. And publicly, you know, I never saw anything, you know, distancing themselves from this. And very few Democrats, as of now, are willing to take any ownership. I mean, the very fact that we have cabinet secretary number one, cabinet secretary number two, and cabinet secretary number three the book, as opposed to their actual names, all of them are respected people who, you know, probably a lot of people would only, their regard for them would only grow. But they're still afraid of being seen as disloyal, being seen as doing anything to help Trump, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so that's why that person didn't come forward.
You know, one thing that Biden and many of his closest supporters have said many times is that his ability to govern was never diminished. Did any of the sources that you speak to give examples of times when they did feel like his ability to govern was diminished?
It's so interesting. So as we were talking with people, I think the ones that were at least candid, they'll acknowledge that, yes, his schedule was limited. Often he was best at 10 to 4. Yes, he had trouble speaking and communicating. Yes, he would forget longtime aides' names and get lost in his own thoughts. But then say, but every decision he made, he was as good as ever. And a lot of people around them just don't agree with that. And it seems like if you're going to acknowledge all the other stuff, how could that not have been diminished as well, if that makes sense? And, you know, we had cabinet secretaries, multiple cabinet secretaries tell us that, you know, if there was a crisis at 2 a.m., they would have been worried. They did not have confidence that he would have been a reliable commander-in-chief with a middle-of-the-night crisis.
If I could just weigh in on this, I'll give you just two quick examples. One, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner, loyal Democrat from Virginia, is very concerned because he hears that the Biden administration is considering releasing 11 detainees from Gitmo, Yemenis, and sending them to Oman. This is after the October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas. And he and many other senators are worried that these guys, or at least, you know, some of them, are going to rejoin the fight against the West or against Israel, whether it's with Hamas or Hezbollah or the Houthis or whatever. He calls Jake Sullivan, expresses his concern, Warner. Biden calls Warner, and it becomes very clear to Warner in that call that Biden really is not up to speed on the issue and really maybe not fully aware of everything going on in a way that upset him, not just like, oh, he hadn't been briefed, but in a way that disturbed Senator Warner. So if that's part of the national security aspect of this. I mean, I think that that is a question about his governance and his decision making. By the way, those Yemenis were released, not then, but like before Trump came to office. The other story is there was a really disturbing moment, and you can see it. It's on video. It was in June 2024. It's an immigration event, and Biden is speaking publicly in the middle of the day, not late at night. And he's talking, and he kind of has some sort of, I mean, doctors told us it looked like a neurological event, where he just starts talking into a microphone. And it's not just that weird thing he does where he whispers to make an emphasis. It's like you can't understand what he's saying, and it's very disturbing.
Thanks to all the members of Congress and Homeland Security Secretary. I'm not sure I'm going to introduce you all the way. But all kidding aside, Secretary Mayorkas.
And I mean, the news media honestly doesn't even have the vocabulary to describe this kind of thing. When Fox described it, they said he forgot the name of the DHS secretary. But that's like a charitable interpretation. And I'm not faulting Fox for how they covered it. But it's like that's kind of a charitable interpretation. Not that I think they were trying to be charitable. I just think people don't. We're not doctors out here. We don't know what that was. But it was a really weird moment. Anyway, Senator Mike Bennett of Colorado is in the audience. And he, based on this entire experience, comes to the conclusion that now I understand why our immigration policy is such a mess. This guy is not capable of brokering all the competing factions and dynamics on immigration. The hardliners who wanted to secure the border and were told that Biden would take steps to do so early on in the administration, led by DHS Secretary Mayorkas, that never happened. There were a lot of activists who had, you know, the opposite policy belief on these issues. They really ruled for a long time within the administration. Then all of a sudden in 2023, it swung back to trying to secure the border, et cetera. And Bennett came to the conclusion, like, this is why it's a mess, because this president is incapable of being president, of governing, of saying, no, that's not what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen, of making the decisions. He's not doing it. And that's why the immigration policy is all over the map, literally and figuratively. So I really would disagree very strongly with the premise of the Biden administration's argument. And this is just what we were able to find out.
I mean, we've talked about the debate, of course, and how much of a turning point that was. But let's talk about what came after the debate. It seems like the White House and people close to the Biden campaign refer to that period of time just after the debate as the bad times. Can you say a little more about this period, what the Biden camp was talking about, and really what was happening within the Democratic Party at the time?
Yeah, I mean, this is a party coming to grips with that they've been silent for too long. And now this is reaching a crisis level. It's not just about the White House. It's about the House. It's about the Senate. They're not just saying Trump's going to win. They're like, he's going to take down all of us. And you have a Biden White House in denial. People keep saying, you have to go out there. You have to go out there. They wait a week to go and do their first interview. And the interview didn't bring about much confidence. And Biden says that, you know, this answer that really frustrated a lot of Democrats at the time was,
I feel as long as I gave it my all and I did the goodest job as I know I can do. That's what this is about.
And Democrats are like, that's not reassuring. The stakes are bigger here. And essentially what you see is like a party overthrowing their nominee in a stubborn president resisting until it was clear that it was going to be a bloodbath to remain the nominee.
Which was so not clear to him because it seems like that data was really not being shared with him.
Yeah, talk about a cover-up.
Yeah,
his own staff was hiding the polling from him. Donilon and Ricchetti were giving the rosiest possible interpretation of the data. This became a real talking point for Obama, Hakeem Jeffries, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer in that three-week-plus period between the debate and Biden dropping out on July 21st. They were trying to get him to get access to the polling. The three pollsters, the outside pollsters, Murphy, Guerin, and Pollack, never talked to Biden. They were never allowed to speak with him. And, you know, they'd been having concerns about his age and the impact of his age on his candidacy for months, but they never got to talk to him. And finally, Chuck Schumer is able to confront Joe Biden and say, I've talked to your pollsters, have you? They think you only have a 5% chance of winning.
Yeah, this conversation that you all outline in the book is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Schumer really speaking with Biden, really confronting Biden with the numbers, it sounds like.
The
maybe
only
for
one.
The first time.
The only, yeah. He's the only one that we can find that actually said to Biden, if I were you, I would drop out. He's the only one we can find saying that. But before that, Nancy Pelosi, in a secret meeting at the White House, at the residence, Nancy Pelosi, she's such an interesting person. She, first of all, she stepped down as Democratic leader on her own volition. And second of all, she's considered one of the best Democratic tacticians in the last 25 years. I mean, when you just look at whatever you think of her as a person or whether or not you agree with her policies, she was able to do things, winning back the House, et cetera, that a lot of people weren't able. And flash forward to 2024, she is pressing President Biden to look at the data because she can't believe what she has seen. She can't believe what she's heard. She's hearing from loyal Democrats all over the country who are saying their kids who are Democrats are not going to vote because, I mean, they just had a very low opinion of Joe Biden and they thought he was an addled old man. And she couldn't believe that this was not getting through to the president. She just was pushing. Please look at the data. But Schumer finally expressed what the data said.
Let's talk a little bit about the media's role in all of this.
Our favorite topic.
How you see... Our least favorite topic. We're all part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all part of it. And in the spirit of hindsight, right?
I mean,
really, though, to talk about how you've been thinking about your own reporting over the Biden years. More specifically, I mean, what's your personal reflection for your own work, but also just in general, what is your critique of the media in this moment? What was the role of the media in how this all played out?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. You know, it's tough to report when people aren't talking or not telling you the truth. That being said, I do think it's a moment where the media fell short. And I think it's a good reminder that every White House, every person with power, no matter if they come from sort of an earnest crew, they're all capable of lying. They're all capable of deception. They're all capable of lying to themselves and being in denial. And I think there are a lot of reporters that did good work on this topic, but I don't think anyone can say with a straight face that they did enough. Because if we had done enough, then the debate would not have come as such a shock and surprise. And so that's on us. And, you know, I think it's just like, you know, we should have been more discerning. We should have been tougher and not taken people's word at face value.
Jake, what are you thinking about in this
moment?
Well,
I mean, look, it's impossible to look back at my coverage of that era and of the Biden years and not feel humility about how I covered things and what I did not know. But that said, our reporting suggests that this was a deterioration, and the Politburo and President Biden and his family were trying to hide him as much as possible from the public and from the media. And they were not only lying to the public and the media, they were lying to their cabinet. They were lying to Democratic donors. They were lying to Democratic office holders, which is why there are so many who are angry. We did not know so many of these things. And obviously, if we had known them at the time, we would have reported them. I mean, in the book, we have the story that the New Yorker excerpted and is obviously a very cogent story of President Biden meeting with George Clooney behind the stage of the June 2024 fundraiser. And despite knowing Clooney for more than 15 years, despite having met with him privately, despite the fact that Clooney is co-hosting the event, and despite the fact that George Clooney is one of the most recognizable faces in the world, he didn't recognize him. He did not recognize George Clooney. And, you know, that's an anecdote. Of course, I wish I'd known in June of 2024, but I didn't. And, you know, all we can do is try to report as much as possible on this now. And, you know, we interviewed more than 200 people. And I think while, you know, I'm here for the self-flagellation and I'll do it as much as anybody wants me to do it, it's kind of not the point. The point is now what we were able to uncover and how do we as a country make sure this never happens again? It can never be allowed to happen again.
What do you think needs to change in Washington for this dynamic to ultimately shift for us to not end up in a position like this again?
Well, so there's two parts to that. I think one is there is no mechanism requiring disclosure of health for elected officials, let alone the person with their finger on the nuclear button. And we end the book this way with some people saying there needs to be a real discussion of mandatory disclosure of health. Mm. There's a second sort of dynamic that I think you are alluding to, which is just where people are loyal to their party or to their guy over the larger mission. And I think in a very polarized partisan atmosphere, that's harder to fix. And mm-hmm. I just think it requires probably just like self-reflection, the same way media is reflecting. And I think it just takes people, I think Washington would be a lot better if people remembered the larger stakes of their jobs and positions beyond what's just good for my guy.
Mm. I have to say also, like, there are a lot of people attacking us for either why are you covering this and not Donald Trump from the left, or you didn't cover this enough and now you're just cashing in on it from the right, or whatever. And that's, you know, whatever. Again, that's fine. It's part of the business. But that incentive structure is part of why I think a lot of people didn't cover this during, and what by cover, I mean actually get to the bottom of what was really going on. There's a disincentive structure. You look at what happened to Siobhan Hughes and Annie Linsky from the Wall Street Journal when they published their story, like heroic reporters who wrote about this to the best of their ability in June 2024, when sources were not as freely speaking as they are willing to be with us now. Look at what happened to them. The entire Democratic Party, like, you know, trying to execute them, you know, tried to destroy them. Not credible, right-wing hacks, blah, blah, blah. When all they were doing was reporting. And honestly, it had to be traumatizing for them to have Democratic senators openly questioning their reporting. Senators who just a few weeks later in our book are behind the scenes telling the Politburo that Joe Biden should get two neurologists to independently review him, or Senator Patty Murray saying, basically suggesting he should step down because of his legacy. Like, Murray and Jack Reed, respected senators, both of them publicly questioning the Wall Street Journal reporting, and weeks later privately suggesting that Biden is not up for the job. I mean, what does that say?
Well, let's talk about Trump for just a quick moment. And this is not a zero sum. Why didn't you also write a whole complete other book about Trump's mental health? But, you know, here is President Trump, another very old president. We've seen him confuse the name of world leaders. We've seen him go on rambles. We've seen him seeming to forget words. Is this another media mistake in the making?
Well, it's not. I don't think it's necessarily a mistake yet. That being said, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, he is older than Joe Biden was when Joe Biden was inaugurated. He's the oldest president ever to be inaugurated. And we know almost nothing about his health. And there are many parts of his health report that don't appear to necessarily be true, or at least make you a little skeptical. There's definitely reasons to be concerned that the most powerful person in the world is very old, and we know almost nothing about his real health.
Hmm. And that's also one of the reasons to write this book is, even for, you know, Biden supporters out there or Democratic supporters out there, first of all, George Clooney, when asked about the argument, like, why are you talking about Biden? Why are you not talking about Trump? He's like, how do you think we got Trump? That's the Clooney view. But beyond that, every precedent in this town that gets destroyed gets abused by the next guy. The deception that Biden was able to do just helps the next guy, literally or figuratively, do his deception. I mean, it just does. Because it's like, oh, well, I don't remember anybody saying anything about Joe Biden, blah, 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 blah. And that's one of the other reasons why this is so important, beyond just the fact that it is empirically important and was a calamity and a tragedy and a disgrace. Joe Biden just made it easier for the next Joe Biden. I mean, like, until there are steps taken. And as Alex alluded to, like, I don't have much faith that anybody's going to do that. There should be a requirement, as Dr. Jonathan Reiner says at the end of the book, that these health reports are submitted under penalty of perjury. But they're only even put out there as a tradition. It's not required. It's like when Gerald Ford started releasing his tax returns in 76 and Jimmy Carter, and that set a great precedent. And then Donald Trump stopped. And there it is. So this is disturbing. And the participation, complicity, silence of Democrats to this moment is still alarming.
Mm. All of the work that went into this book, all the stories that you've been sitting with now and digesting for the past 6 months, how has it affected the way that you think about Washington and our politics today? What's going to stay with you?
I think at the end of the day, despite the stakes being really large, the personal affects the political. And at times, it's just a handful of people in a room that you think there's some sort of check or enforcing responsibility, but often there isn't. It's just, it's a very, you know, Shakespearean gets thrown around all the time. But like, you know, Shakespeare, I think, always saw how the personal affected the political. And I think in some ways, it's just a very human story, an aging person, patriarch, with people around him who love him. But it was on the world stage with enormous stakes, but it's still a very, like, human story.
It's a sad story, really. I mean, if you strip away the politics of it all, which is difficult to do, but you look at what it is, the story of a man who defies so many odds from the very beginning of his life when he, you know, was born into humble circumstances and he has a debilitating stutter. You know, his wife and kid are killed in a tragic car accident right after he wins a Senate seat. I mean, there are just so many things thrown at this guy. And every time he's able to get up and dust himself off and persevere. And that very trait seals his doom. His belief that he can withstand anything guarantees that he will not only have an ignominious end of his career that I think, I mean, again, I don't speak for history, but like, I think this will be a permanent stain on his legacy. But beyond that, you know, I don't, Alex and I, neither of us have any personal animus towards Joe Biden or Jill Biden or Hunter Biden or Mike Donilon or Steve Ricchetti. I mean, we covered the facts of what they did and how they did it. And we tried to be as clear-eyed as possible. But, you know, it's not like this is a hatchet job. I think that we try to explain their points of view and their view of the world as often as we can. It's just that quite often their views of the world were completely at odds with facts and reality.
Well, Alex and Jake, thank you both for coming on, for talking about the book, for sharing your reporting.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
It's such an honor to be here. Thank you.
You can read Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, its cover-up, and his disastrous choice to run again by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson on Apple Books. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.